The Metal AI Podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Felix Beecher, and this is the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We talk to a range of top guests, from industry innovators to scientists to philosophers. This is brought to you by Informatech, where I'm the head of healthcare technology. There are many research groups and companies developing excellent products in medical AI. But some succeed and some fail. What is the difference between the two? To discuss that, I have somebody who is a real expert in this question, and this podcast will be pure gold for anyone interested in developing a strategy for new medical AI products. A very big and warm welcome to Dr. Hugh Harvey from Hardy & Health. Hugh, very much welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Felix. Excited to be chatting today.
Great. All right. Well, look, let's start off with you just introducing yourself and explaining a little about what Hardy & Health does.
Sure. Thank you. I'm Dr. Harvey. I was a consultant radiologist in the NHS, and I left clinical practice to go into industry several years ago now. And I've had the privilege of working in a couple of AI-driven medtech startups, Babylon Health and then Chiron Medical. And since then, I have just been acting as an independent advisor for many other AI medtech startups, not just from the UK, but around the world. And over the years, since 2018, built out the business, Hardian. Now we've got a team of 20, and we try and help accelerate people bring their AI-driven, software-driven products to market. It can be a tough journey, as you've just alluded to, and not everyone will make it. And there are certain prerequisites and barriers to get there, and we try and help people overcome them as easily as possible, though easy is not always the word that people will ascribe to the process, I can assure you.
Okay, so could you say something about why this general area is important?
The general area of AI in medicine just holds a lot of promise, really. People are looking towards these new types of technologies to help do two things mainly: automate away the mundane and the routine, but also to elevate current practice by having a second set of eyes or some kind of assistance in day-to-day tasks, especially tasks that require processing of a lot of input data. And that could come in many forms, and we can get onto the different types later. But in essence, those are the sort of two key areas where people are focusing on. Both require a certain level of diligence and robustness in their approaches. Clinical evidence is going to be required at all stages. Regulatory approval, health economic evidence, and having a good strategy around the whole process as well is really key. So it's an exciting topic. It's something that has grown massively since I started back in 2014, and just keeps getting faster and faster.
Yeah, absolutely. It's dizzying, isn't it? Well, look, Hugh, I suspect, I'm not sure, but that you might be British. Now, clearly, different countries around the world have different processes for approving medical AI devices and any kind of medical devices. So do you deal in Hardy & Health with just British companies, or do you work globally?
Absolutely globally. The majority of our clients are not from this island. We have a lot of European, American and other countries represented in our client base. The medical device regulations do differ around the world, but there are some harmonised international standards and processes that can help drive more global adoption. But yeah, we don't just deal with UK companies, although obviously that's where we are based. And actually, I'm not 100% British. I was born in Belgium, so I feel 50% European myself.
Quite right. So do you have particular disease areas that you specialise in?
No, not at all. We started out just focusing on radiology, mainly because that's where the majority of AI systems were first being developed and deployed. And as a consultant radiologist, I sort of came out of my time in academic research with a good understanding of the capabilities of machine learning at that time.
Yeah.
It's since accelerated to the point where I can't keep up. I doubt anybody actually can. But yeah, radiology, if you look at it, is a data-driven profession. We take digital images of pretty much any part of the body and we store them digitally. We present them in a digital format to radiologists. And so it's just ripe for that kind of data-driven paradigm that, that AI thrives on, to have that, that rich data substrate that's uniform in nature, pretty yeah. much. But no, we don't just focus on radiology products. We are involved with a multitude of patient-facing apps, a lot of them to do with mental health. We do a lot of what's called in vitro diagnostics. So these are AI systems that actually look at outputs from tissue sampling or blood sampling of patients. So there's a lot of work in the cancer yeah. space, some fecal biomarker space, blood biomarkers and things like that. And then we're also seeing digital pathology companies come forward with AI products. And now we've got this whole world of generative AI, which is just on the cusp of causing some kind of Cambrian explosion of, right. of new products. And no one knows how to regulate or get those to market yet, though people are certainly starting to try.
Yeah, I think, well, you've mentioned two things that are potentially quite connected there. Firstly, therapies for psychological conditions or mental health apps, and also large language models, right? Now, I think it's, and of course it's still very, very fresh, but I can imagine that large language models like ChatGPT, Bard, etc., could be quite easily adapted to perform CBT kind of therapy for mental health conditions. Is that a growth area, do you think?
It is a growth area, and there are multiple CBT apps and companies at the moment who are all relying on a kind of rules-based CBT process within their systems. They're not using an underlying language model per se, they're sort of pre-programming set phrases and set things based on a rules-based paradigm. And that's relatively simple to regulate because yeah. you can demonstrate quality assurance fairly simply by showing that you're using gold standard phrasing. Where the large language models come in is maybe a more personalized and a feeling of a system that can actively change and develop as a therapeutic process goes on. But the regulatory and the clinical evidence parameters are really unclear in that paradigm mm-hmm. because you have potentially infinite types of input and infinite types of output. And these large language models currently are prone to hallucination and bias and don't necessarily always give accurate answers. So difficult to quality assure, difficult to measure clinical accuracy and performance currently.
But I would presume that the basic technology could be adapted for use in, for example, and by the way, for anyone who is listening doesn't know what CBT is, I should say it's cognitive behavioral therapy, right? Yes. I would imagine that large language models could be adapted for specific use purposes like CBT, and they might actually be better than what is easily regulated, but nonetheless simpler and less sophisticated. So you have these potentially this kind of funny paradox between something that is regulatable, if that's a word, and something that is optimal.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see where the research goes on this. And I think, you know, I am positioning myself as a healthy skeptic, but also with a practical hat on. So the idea is certainly there, and we aren't the first people to be discussing this for sure. The question remains is how do you actually achieve this in an economically viable way? OpenAI trained ChatGPT at the cost of, I think, billions of dollars. And clearly that's not an economically viable way to produce a therapeutic chatbot, for instance. You're not going to recoup the development costs on that. But it's a new technology, and as with all new technologies, prices and costs come down over time. And I think once that starts happening and people can start building more focused models for specific purposes, then we'll be able to start to get a measure of how do these actually perform in the real world. How much human in the loop do you need at the start? Because I imagine that you can't just release these systems fresh out of the box onto patients with mental health conditions. That sounds dangerous to me. Yeah. So there's work to be done, for sure. Yeah. Early days, but I am excited to see where it goes and to try and figure out that puzzle of how you would actually get one safely to market that demonstrably works and provides some kind of economic benefit as well.
Now, let's cover the general process for getting a medical AI product to market. So let's just imagine, for argument's sake, that we have Company X that have designed a phone app to diagnose skin lesions. Those skin lesions could be moles, they could be cancers, they could be eczema, they could be something else, right? So there's a kind of range of risk involved in misdiagnosing. Mm-hmm. Let's say that this company X has compiled some clinical evidence, is pretty convinced, and it wants to negotiate the process of getting it to market. Can you explain what that journey looks like in general terms?
Sure. I mean, so the first thing, the starting point in all medical device regulation is what's known as the intended use. What do you actually intend the device to do, and on whom, and in which contexts and situations, and with which limitations? So let's take your example of skin cancer detection. So we could say the intended use is to provide a direct diagnosis of the pathology behind a given skin lesion based on a photo taken through a smartphone, let's say. And that sounds really interesting, but you very quickly have to start to limit it. So are you actually intending it to be used on children and adults? Are you intending it to be used on all skin tones, so people with very dark to very light skin tones? If so, you then have to prove it works in adults and children and people with all of the different skin tones. So you can quickly see that the intended use helps refine that product down into a kind of guide rail of where it can actually operate. And that's important because you will need to provide clinical evidence, as you said, and you'll need to provide evidence of everything that you are claiming it can do. And you also have to look at what are the potential risks. So clearly with a diagnostic system, the risks are twofold. You can have false positives where you overcall melanoma, for instance. And the other risk is you can undercall it. You can miss a cancer. So you have to figure out, well, in which of those groups of the patients I intend to be used on, where are the biggest risks? How am I going to mitigate these? And what you'll find is actually that most of the skin analytical AI systems that are out there, they actually exclude the very darkest skin tones for this reason, because there's not enough training data, or because the resolution of the camera smartphone can't delineate the boundaries of dark lesions on dark skin very easily, for instance. So you have to start limiting it. But once you've undergone that exercise and really deeply understood what your, you know, what the target population is and where it's going to be used, is it outpatient, inpatient, by a doctor, by a patient, etc. Once you've done all of that, then you have to go through a process called risk classification. And very broadly speaking, all medical devices are bucketed into three major risk classes. Class one, which is the lightest, the lowest risk, up to class three, which is very high risk. And to give practical examples, a class one device can be something like a wooden tongue depressor, very low risk device, not really going to harm anybody if it snaps in half. But high risk devices, class three, are ones that can cause severe morbidity or even mortality. So these can be things like CT scanners, which emit radiation, for instance. Clearly, you want the software that's running your CT scanner to function correctly, so you're not irradiating people unnecessarily. So that's how you risk classify it. And by and large, 99% of software in the medical device space is going to be class two or higher. And that is defined in the medical device regulations. Software can very occasionally be class one, but then it is very kind of hobbled by its intended use. You're not allowed to use it to diagnose or treat, for instance, if it's only class one. You can only use it as a kind of information system. And so a lot of these software companies place themselves in what's known as the decision support space. So they lower their risk class by saying, we're not giving a firm diagnosis of skin cancer. What we will say is, you are at high risk of skin cancer, please see an appropriate physician.
Yeah.
And then you can see that immediately lowers the economic viability of the product. Because you aren't removing a human from the loop. You might be speeding up time to diagnosis, or speeding up or making more accurate an early triage, but you aren't actually doing the diagnosis yourself because you've limited yourself away out of that diagnostic process. So that's the very, very basics of medical device regulation, is write down what your device does, figure out what risk class it is.
That's a beautiful summary. Let's stick with our example of skin cancer detection for a moment. Now, let's say somebody has a melanoma. They run it through their skin app, and the skin app says, I think it's fine, but go and see your doctor to check. Now, they're busy. They don't read small print, so they can't be bothered to go and see their doctor. They are reassured that they don't have skin cancer, whereas in fact, they do. Now, that person could potentially die because they are following what they think is the instructions of the phone app. Now, could that not be an argument for saying, well, actually, this is a pretty high-risk product, should be class 3?
So you're right. And actually, because they're claiming, they're not claiming a direct diagnosis, but they are claiming to be able to triage accurately, they are actually driving clinical management. And that's the regulatory term. You can either inform clinical management, where a doctor will always review the output of your device, or you can drive clinical management, where it might be patient-facing or doctor-facing, but the output is designed to be relied upon as good enough to decide whether or not further action needs to be taken. That's known as driving clinical management. And that will put you potentially, because this is a serious or critical condition, as what's known as class 2B. So class 2 is actually split into two risk classes, class 2A and class 2B. And that comes with a higher regulatory burden, that the level of clinical evidence you have to produce is higher, and the quality assurance processes you have to document need to be more robust as well. You could become class 3 if you are actually claiming to make the definitive diagnosis, but I'm not aware of any apps, at least, that are claiming to do that just yet.
Now, let's think of another example. Let's say there's a phone app for assessing body fat composition. And maybe it does that on the basis of a photo of your face or your body, I don't know. Now, that seems to me to be a pretty low risk kind of medical device, but it's, or AI is a medical device. Would you consider that to be class 1 or class 2?
That's a very good question. So again, I would try and go back to the intended use. Why are we measuring body fat? Mm-hmm. And what level of accuracy are we claiming? For instance, so let's assume that we're just saying, look, we can tell if you are overweight or not, which is might come under health and well-being rather than medical use. But what it is doing is making a measurement. So let's say it gives you a measurement. It's saying, you know, your body fat is an X percentage, 20%, 10%, whatever it is. Then you're making a measurement. So there's an argument here. You could be a low risk device because clearly your output doesn't really come under any critical condition. And getting the measurement wrong is not really going to damage anybody, particularly in a harmful way. So you could argue potentially that it was a class 1 device, but it would be known as what's known as a class 1M device, which is a measurement device. So therefore, you have to prove that your measurement is accurate. So you would have to show in some kind of clinical study that the percentage body fat that you're claiming your app can measure actually has some real-world correlation with actual body fat percentage.
Right.
So you have to show the accuracy of that. But a class 1 device doesn't have to be audited externally by independent regulators. You can self-certify. And this is where we come across a slight loophole and a fault in the regulations, is that people or companies, they get attracted to going for class 1 because there's less regulatory burden. But it really hobbles their product in terms of the utility of it.
Yeah.
You can't claim that it's actually clinically useful in any meaningful way other than that it's an accurate measurement. And it also means that some people will self-certify, but they're naughty and they don't do all the documentation that's actually required. They just say they've done it. Imagine if there was a driving license exam for people who wanted to learn to drive a car, where you could self-certify and say, yep, I'm pretty good at driving, I'm self-certifying. And then you put all those people out on the roads. You can quickly imagine that those people are actually more likely to cause harm on the roads than people who've passed the proper test.
Yeah,
and that's exactly the same with class 1 medical devices. Is I actually do a lot of work with people who are procuring devices, and they go, oh, it's class 1, it's not that bad. I'm like, yeah, but it hasn't had any quality assurance. It's actually got more risk associated with it in terms of the scale and scope of potential harm.
Okay, now you You work with a wide range of different clients. Could you give some general tips or advice on how to negotiate the approval and the marketing process?
So I always tell people, start exploring the regulatory pathways from day one. As soon as you think you're going to be in medical device territory, start exploring. Start writing down your intended use or even iterations of it. And we do this as an exercise with clients all the time. They come to us with an idea and we say, well, that will be class 2B. And they say, oh, we don't want to do that yet. We're not ready. So we help them write iterations of the intended use so they could come onto market and maybe as a class 1 device. And then over time, add functionality, do the relevant clinical studies and documentation, and then get an audit at some point down the line to become class 2 or higher. So always my day one piece of advice is think about the regulatory process early. And yeah. The second thing is, don't do a clinical study until you understand where it's going to fit into your regulatory processes. We come across startups and clients the entire time who think that they've done some kind of massive clinical study that's going to get them regulatory approval, but they actually didn't test the things they're claiming in their intended use quite often, and then they have to repeat. So if you think you've done a pivotal study and you haven't thought about the regulatory processes, then you probably haven't done a pivotal study. And the second part of that is, you really need to do the studies properly. There are standards, there are international standards of how to do, you know, good clinical evidence, how to report them. And it all starts with a literature review. And people often skip that part. They'll go straight into a clinical study to measure whatever they're claiming, but they haven't actually done a literature review to say, well, what are our competitors claiming? What's their performance? What's the performance of clinicians in the real world? What's the benchmark that we should be measuring ourselves against? And people start doing the wrong tests. And they're doing this with all the large language models. They're testing them on human exams. So, for instance, you've got large language models that can pass some medical school exams. That's the wrong test. Because unless you're designing a system which you're claiming its intended use is to pass a medical school exam, then you're doing the wrong test. So really, people need to think harder about what is the actual evidence criteria they need to generate to back up the claims that they're making in their intended use.
Okay. Now, let's talk about intellectual property a little bit, because I think this is an important part of the process too. Could you speak to that in general?
Sure. So IP is another thing that we do at Hardgin. We have a very respected intellectual property lawyer on our team called Stephen Carter, and he specializes in working with startups. And IP can be extremely tricky, especially for spin-outs where universities want to retain quite a large percentage of intellectual property in any research that gets put out into a private entity. And IP is super important. And when people are applying for grants, they'll quickly realize why it's important, because there's often a requirement to demonstrate you have what is known as freedom to operate. Do you actually own the intellectual property of the technology that you're trying to bring to market? Because you could spend millions of pounds or dollars getting something to market, and then someone else goes, well, thanks very much. I own the patent for that. I'll have all of your assets, please. And that happens all the time. One very big case was AliveCor, which is an ECG analysis company who developed a portable ECG analysis device. They got FDA regulatory approval in America. And then Apple came along and got FDA regulatory approval for very similar software in their Apple Watch. And AliveCor successfully sued Apple for intellectual property infringement. So IP is in two parts. One is owning your own patentable technology, and two is not infringing on other people's technology and intellectual property rights. And then there's a third aspect to it, which is trademarking as well. A lot of companies try and come up with clever names, but there's only so many acronyms with the words AI in it that you can have. And someone already owns the trademark for the thing that you're doing already. So we do a lot of work with companies, sometimes having to rename entirely to get around trademark and IP infringement. So it's a super important part of the process. And I'd like to highlight one more really important thing about IP. Mm-hmm. And that is to do with the American regulatory system, as opposed to the European regulatory system. So in America, a technology company can apply for a fast-tracked regulatory approval through an FDA process known as the 510K submission process. I don't know what 510K stands for, it's just what the process is called. But in essence, you can claim fast track regulatory approval by saying that you are equivalent to a device that is already on market in America and has regulatory approval. So yeah. You say, I am substantially equivalent. My intended use is the same. My performance benchmarks are the same or non-inferior to the other product. And we don't raise any significant new safety concerns because we are essentially the same product. And so you can see that, you know, the FDA will then fast track you for regulatory approval. They'll be saying, well, we've already audited something like this. Yours looks similar. You've shown it's the same. You can go on market. But you have said in a legal, publicly available document, your technology is the same as somebody else's. So you really will struggle in a court of law to demonstrate that you have freedom to operate and you own the intellectual property behind that technology. And that's going to be a huge problem in the upcoming IP wars, as our in-house lawyer calls them, especially around markets that are becoming saturated, such as the radiology AI market. There are 20 companies with chest x-ray AI. Yeah. Only one is going to own the legal patent, at least the one that covers the American territories. So it's going to be a super interesting space to watch and monitor in the future.
That really is fascinating. And could you say something about what actually precisely is protected? Because it's not computer code, right? Which I think will surprise some people. What actually is it?
So that's right. So we often get the question, can I patent an algorithm? And the answer is sort of. You can patent the care pathway redesign that your algorithm enables. You can't patent lines of code. So you have to think very hard about how your product actually fits into a care pathway. Where does it fit in the IT infrastructure and in the real world workflow in that clinical domain? And if you can patent the processes by which data gets acquired, processed through your AI, an output gets delivered, and then something happens, whether it's a treatment decision or a diagnostic decision, if you can patent that process, then you can have protection. What you can't do is just try and patent your code. So you can't just say, I've got an algorithm which takes this input and produces that output and patent that, because that technology really isn't novel. Anybody can come up with an idea of putting something into a machine and getting an output out. It's the care pathway process that's patentable.
But that sounds very vague. And I guess that's why lawyers get paid quite a lot of money.
This is why you need an IP lawyer. It's incredibly vague, complex and tricky. And as I said, it's going to come out in the wash. MedTech as a sector is relatively young, maybe 5 to 10 years old, if you think about just the current deep learning systems. And I think there's going to be IP battles for sure around these things and people trying to demonstrate that they've got some kind of defensible moat. But sometimes, as I said, they've applied for a 510K and they've just said they're the same as someone else. And that someone else could turn around and sue them for patent infringement.
Okay. One thing you mentioned in your intro was that you worked previously for Babylon Health, which I think is especially interesting because it's so controversial and was a kind of test case for what can be done with medical AI. Could you just explain a little bit about that case and how things developed in the UK in particular?
Sure. So I worked at Babylon Health in about 2016 for a year, and I was brought on as just a sort of clinical specialist helping to train their AI systems, which at the time were relatively rudimentary compared to what we have currently in these days. But there was a large decision tree model with Bayesian logic underneath it. And part of the clinicians' jobs were to help refine that Bayesian model to make sure that it was making logical or sensible steps through a decision tree of medical questions. So it was a patient-facing chatbot with the intended use of providing triage and an indicative differential diagnostic list. So you would get 3 to 5 potential diagnostic outcomes and then a triage decision saying you should see a doctor or you should see your GP or you're fine, but maybe put some cream on it or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was most of our work. And then one day the regulators, the MHRA in the UK, they knocked on the door and said, did you know you're a medical device? And obviously no one did. I was asked to sort of solve that problem. And that's how I fell into medical device regulation. I had to read the medical device regulations from scratch. I had to negotiate with the MHRA about how we could become compliant and managed to register as a class one device, which was allowable at the time. The regulations have since changed and that kind of chatbot is not class one, it's class two. Yeah. But back then it was allowed to be class one. So that was the first ever CE marked AI chatbot. So that was, you know, tick on my CV. And then we started building a quality management system and trying to figure out how we could get to class two. I'm not sure if Babylon ever got that. I left at that point to go and join another company, but the technology was always being iterated and changed, and I hope they maintained their quality management system as it was initially set up and designed. But then, of course, Babylon went on to have a public offering on the New York Stock Exchange, and the share price has dropped drastically. I think I believe about 96%. I haven't seen the latest figures, but clearly there wasn't public confidence that the Babylon as a company was going to return value to shareholders. And I cannot speak as to why people thought that. Maybe it was the chatbot wasn't accurate enough. Maybe it was they didn't believe in Babylon's care model. Who knows? But the fact remains that that really has been kind of like a warning flag to the whole sector, is don't grow too fast and too hard and claim things that you can't prove, because the market will turn around and bite you ultimately.
Right. Okay, good. Hugh, I wonder, for my last question, whether I could ask you, could you give us your favourite current example of medical AI? Nothing to do with the kind of things that we've been talking about already.
So I think I've got two favourites, really. And I think they are the ones...
That's not strictly allowed, by the way. This is like Desert Island Discs.
Oh, Desert Island.
I'll let it go. It's fine.
Yeah, I think... I do want to say two, because there's one that actually works and the evidence is growing and it will actually transform part of the NHS. And that's what my other company did, Chiron Medical, is breast AI screening. I still truly believe that it can actually transform the breast screening paradigm in the UK, simply because we have a very robust screening program where two consultant radiologists review every mammogram. And the AI is demonstrably as good as at least one of those radiologists. So you could reduce the workforce requirement for AI by almost 50%. I say almost because the AI slightly overcalls, and so you need a bit more arbitration, whereby if the AI and the human disagree, there's slightly more cases to arbitrate. But you can reduce the workforce capacity required in breast screening by a significant amount. And there are ongoing prospective studies to prove that, and the results are all fairly positive at the moment. So I think that for me is going to happen for sure. We just need that evidence to come through. We need the breast screening committee of the NHS to agree to use it. And it needs to be deployed in a safe, quality assured manner, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of the practical real world example that I think is definitely going to make it. The other side is really exciting, and again it's radiology based, and it's a bit more technically complex, but in essence when we take an MRI scan, it's the data doesn't come out in a nice image format that humans can read straight away. It goes into a format which is known in physics, known as k-space. So the data is sort of 3D volumetric data which humans can't interpret it with their eyes. And actually AI is actually really good at reading this case-based data, because it is just digital data. And people are sort of researching whether or not you can actually produce AI that is much more diagnostically accurate, because we're not asking it to read the human processable images that we transform the case-based into. We're actually reading the raw case-based data, which is actually much more data rich. So I find that incredibly exciting. The problem is, it's really hard to validate, because humans can't read case-based data. So you have to transform it into human-readable format. And then you've got this benchmark that you're trying to compare against, which is de facto not as good as the raw data in and of itself. So a difficult one to clinically validate, but I think potentially is super exciting if we can figure out how to use that raw data format to diagnose or investigate human anatomy at a level, a performance level that is far surpassed current radiology practice. So
yeah,
those are my two Desert Island Discs for you.
That really is fascinating. And where are we at, would you say, with the development of that case-based type diagnosis?
I would say late research to early kind of prototyping phase. Yeah. It was very theoretical for a number of years, but it's now starting to see some acceptance in the academic communities. Yeah. And it's an incredibly difficult thing to design, deploy and measure. So I would expect a few more years of research and studies. But there are certainly companies looking at it. Certainly all the big MRI manufacturers and vendors have got it on their list of things to watch.
That really is fascinating. All right, Hugh, it's been a really brilliant conversation. I really appreciate your time. And good luck with your work with Hardian Health, because it sounds to me like you're doing really fantastic work.
Thank you so much for having me on, Felix. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Hugh. Thank you for listening. I'm Felix Beecher. Ping me on LinkedIn for more information on Omdia's services in healthcare technology. See you next time.